Today on Maine Calling, the legacy and life of Joshua Chamberlain. He is one of Maine's greatest sons, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, the hero of Little Round Top, who ensured a Union victory at the Battle of Gettysburg. Famous in his own time, Ken Burns' documentary film about the Civil War cemented Chamberlain's fame for our time. But there is much more to Chamberlain. He was trained as a minister, served as governor of Maine and president of Bowdoin College, and more than once confronted and calmed violent crowds at the Maine State House. A new biography explores Chamberlain's life. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we speak with the author of the biography, as well as executive director of the Pejepscot History Center, which owns the Joshua L. Chamberlain Museum. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. By Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Few figures in Maine's history are as revered as Joshua Chamberlain. A new biography of Chamberlain paints a fuller picture of the man and his legacy. Today, we're going to speak with Ronald White about that biography. He wrote it. Its title is On Great Fields, The Life and Unlikely Heroism of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. Also with us for the hour, Larissa Picard, who is executive director of the Pejepscot History Center. What are your questions about the life of Joshua Chamberlain? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I can't wait to dig into this conversation. Ron, congratulations on the book. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Jennifer, for the invitation. And it's always a pleasure to be with Larissa. She has been such a friend and been so helpful in writing this biography.
Well, let me just go ahead, Larissa. That.
I'm sorry. So kind of you to say that, Ron, and thank you so much for inviting us today.
Ron, I want to dig in, but first I just want to ask you why. There are other biographies of Joshua Chamberlain. What led you to be interested in Chamberlain and write a fresh biography of his life?
Yes, there are other biographies of Chamberlain. Most of them in recent years have been what I would call a zoom lens. They focused understandably on his exploits at Gettysburg, his Civil War story. I wanted to have what I call a wide angle lens to show the larger story of Chamberlain. I think I would argue that more than any other Civil War veteran, he had more different vocations: professor, governor, college president, a remarkable lecturer, and writer. That full wide-angle story has not been told in many, many years, and I think it needs to be told today.
And Larissa, you believe that this biography adds a great deal to the public knowledge.
Absolutely. I would second everything Ron just said. This is really the first major biography in decades. There is a beloved older biography, Alice Raines Trulock, but she was, sort of borderline in love with her subject, and it does focus very, very heavily on the heroism during the war, which is obviously a part of the story. But Ron's book really delves deep into areas that haven't been as much in the past, his boyhood and young manhood, and some of the heroic acts that came later in his life, and the complicated sides to him as well.
Well, let's start with that childhood, Ron White. Joshua Chamberlain was born in Brewer, Maine, and he was not Joshua Chamberlain for the early part of his life. He was known as Lawrence Chamberlain, correct?
That's correct. And one of my convictions in writing biographies, previous biographies of both Abraham Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant, is that we often skip too quickly over the young person's life. And I say to audiences that think of our own lives. I mean, you may be 40 or 60 or 80, but when you were 14, 16, or 18, that's when you really formed your values, when you formed your beliefs. So I wanted to spend considerable time exploring what it meant to grow up in Brewer, Maine with deeply religious parents, what it meant to go to Bowdoin College with its classical curriculum, what were the values that shaped the person who then spontaneously, in one sense, could act at Little Round Top at Gettysburg.
One thing that struck me about Chamberlain as a young man is that he had a stammer.
Yes, he arrived at Bowdoin deeply conflicted over his stammering or stuttering. Remember, this was a very oral culture. Everything was done by recitation. The first semester, he had to take a class in elocution. So he approached this class with deep fear and trembling, feeling unable to fully participate. And so part of the participation at Bowdoin was a professor who helped him overcome his stammering so that, paradoxically, he would ultimately become professor of rhetoric at Bowdoin College.
I want to skip forward just a little bit to when he had to make a very public speech. It was an important anniversary at Bowdoin College, and he was chosen as student speaker. I'm trying to set the table for you to tell the story that you tell in the book, because it's really quite a story.
Yes, he had won many awards at the college, and he was one of three students chosen to speak at commencement. And he got into that speech, and then suddenly he just froze. He sort of forgot where he was. He didn't necessarily stammer, but he was just filled with fright and left the stage deeply embarrassed that he had failed this great opportunity at the end of his college years.
And my understanding, it was, or from your book, it was Bowdoin's 50th anniversary. And in the audience, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and Franklin Pierce. So not only did he freeze, but he froze with those folks in the audience.
And maybe the audience was part of why he froze and why his nervousness came forward. This young man speaking to these huge luminaries who were the grandiose graduates of the college. This must have been, perhaps for others, a frightening experience also.
Something I think adds up if you think about it, but people might not realize, is that Joshua Chamberlain was at Bowdoin at the same time as Harriet Beecher Stowe and knew her. Talk about that, Ronald, because it's really fascinating how these two lives intersect.
Yes, Calvin Stowe came to Bowdoin in the middle of his student years as professor. His wife was Harriet Beecher Stowe. She had a remarkable vision at First Parish, First Congregational Church, and set about to write a book, which ultimately, at first, was simply chapters in a magazine. It became Uncle Tom's Cabin. And she invited a select group of students to come to her home on Saturday evening, and she began to read these chapters. I don't want to overemphasize how that influenced him, but I think it was his first real engagement with the terrible evil of slavery. So it certainly was influential in his thinking.
And Larissa, I'll turn to you. Many people might not think of Brunswick as something, a place that's on par with, say, Paris or New York City in terms of bringing great intellectual minds together. But there have been these waves of, these eras when Brunswick really was just that.
Oh, absolutely. That's what makes it so exciting and fun to run a historical society and house museums, one of which is the Chamberlain Museum here. Part of that, a large part of that, of course, is the fact that Bowdoin College, at one point, I think, referred to as, a Harvard of the North, when it was first created and settled, that obviously brought all kinds of intellectuals to the area. But some of these minds together at the same time, it's rather awe-inspiring to us today, I think. And to think that we have somebody who helped stir society toward the Civil War, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who lived, you know, a street away from where I'm sitting right now, and Chamberlain, who was at Appomattox to accept the surrender of the Confederacy. People call that the bookends of the Civil War right here in Brunswick. It is pretty powerful stuff.
Ron, Chamberlain is clearly a very talented student and excelled and came out speaking several languages, reading original text in their original language. But when he came back to Bowdoin as a professor and then later as president, he bristled against the traditional curriculum. And one of the things I found so interesting in the book is that there was such a debate about whether to teach science classes, and that Chamberlain was on one side of that debate. Can you talk about his lifelong commitment to expanding the curriculum at Bowdoin?
Yes, one of the things that makes Chamberlain so interesting and compelling is, on the one hand, he was very much wedded to tradition, whether it be the classical traditions taught at the college, whether it was the Christian faith. But on the other hand, he was increasingly open to change. So when he comes to be a professor, he challenges not simply the curriculum, but he challenges the teaching method. He really wanted his students to be involved in what today we would call critical thinking, not simply to recite, but to simply think for themselves. And this, in some ways, put him at odds with his older professors who had been his professors. So this was part of, I think, his leadership. In terms of science, he understood after the Civil War, this was the great intellectual thought current of the time. And on the one hand, the alumni probably understood the college needed a change. But on the other hand, many of them thought that science would be a challenge to their religious faith, and they objected to this. So at Chamberlain's memorial service way into the future in 1914, the then president of the college said Chamberlain was way ahead of his time. Chamberlain's advances in science were not accepted. He wanted a full department of science, but ultimately he had to step back, and that dream was lost. And many students transferred from Bowdoin to other colleges where science was much more accepted than it was at Bowdoin at that moment.
I'm going to go back. Go ahead, Larissa.
I could just jump in. I mean, he was ahead of his time in terms of wanting women to be educated as well. And, that is so ironic with regard to Bowdoin, because it didn't go co-ed until the early 1970s, 70, 71, somewhere in there. That's one of the fascinating things about Chamberlain, and I think why people continually want to know about his story, because he holds all of these interesting, sometimes disparate ideas, and he was a man of his time, yet he was ahead of his time. Not a simple person, very complex and fascinating.
Well, Ronnie said. He was a professor at Bowdoin when he made the decision about whether to fight in the Civil War. He did not have to. Friends encouraged him not to. Tell us about his decision to go, and then what rank he wanted, and what rank he was offered, and what rank he ended up with.
Well, in his time, there would have been literally no elective classes, so he would have known every student who had signed up to fight in the Union Army. Two students signed up to fight in the Confederate Army. And John Cross, the alumni secretary of the college, has also deserves a shout out. Very helpful to me in finding out all of who those students were and which were injured, which were killed. Certainly Chamberlain was learning all of this. So in 1862, President Lincoln has a proclamation saying we need 300,000 more men to fight in the Union Army. In 13 days, Chamberlain telegraphed or wrote to the governor of Maine offering his service. Now, governors were looking for eminent persons who could then help recruit a regiment. A regiment was 1,000 men. And so the governor must have been overjoyed that Chamberlain, who already achieved some reputation, was willing to sign up. So he offered him a colonelcy. And Chamberlain said, no, I don't deserve that. I don't have any military training. And I love the way he said it. He said, I would like to learn and earn my way one day to achieve that rank. So that his decision to turn down the colonelcy said another aspect of his character, which I find rather compelling.
Very thoughtful. Before we go to a break, though, for those in the audience who have not seen Ken Burns' Civil War documentary, or perhaps are young or moved here from somewhere else, don't know about Joshua Chamberlain, Larissa, I'll turn to you. Tell us what made him famous. Tell us about the Battle of Gettysburg and Little Round Top.
That's definitely why many, many people come to the museum, is his heroism leading the 20th Maine Regiment, holding the left flank, July 3rd, 1863, at Gettysburg. But, you know, what we try to do at the museum is talk about the many other aspects of his life that were also incredible, because he was a scholar. He was governor. He was, you know, president of Bowdoin College, and he did all of these other things. He had a very interesting family life. His wife is a fascinating figure. He had children. And so, you know, his heroism is what the story that did get told in the Ken Burns documentary and the movie Gettysburg and so forth. And that's really why a lot of people come to know who he is. But he is also so much more than that.
Ron, tell us about, you talked about how you wanted to delve into his childhood. You wanted to delve into the factors that made him the man he was, so that in that moment, in that historic moment, he was able to make the right decision, summon up the courage, do something that, frankly, most people wouldn't do, which is charge bayonets out at a larger force and succeed. What do you think, what is your answer after spending this time researching this book and trying to get inside the head of Joshua Chamberlain? What made it possible for him to have that much wisdom and courage at that moment?
Well, he signed up because of the value of duty. This was his duty. But then the 20th Maine was led by another great Mainer, Adelbert Ames, who was a 26-year-old West Point graduate who came to take the lead, and the men just hated him because he was a strict disciplinarian. But Chamberlain was willing to learn that discipline from someone 7 years younger than himself. And so when they finally got to Gettysburg, their discipline paid off. They were willing to respond. They were willing to do what in one sense was spontaneous, but in another sense, they'd been prepared for this by almost 10 months of training and discipline. And I think that says a lot about his own value. He understood what Adelbert Ames had to offer him. And the day after Little Round Top, Adelbert Ames wrote him a note congratulating him, sort of saying, you did what we wanted you to do. And I thought that note from Adelbert Ames really said everything about the person Chamberlain had become.
We're talking about Joshua Chamberlain on Maine Calling, one of our guests today, the author of a new biography, On Great Fields, The Life and Unlikely Heroism of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. I don't even think halfway through his life. What are your questions about him? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or send a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about one of Maine's favorite sons, Joshua Chamberlain. My guest, Larissa Picard, who is executive director of the Pajebscot History Center, and historian and author Ronald C. White, author of the recently published On Great Fields, The Life and Unlikely Heroism of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. Share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Ron, I wanted to ask you about something that Larissa had alluded to before, mentioned before, is Joshua Chamberlain's role at Appomattox and the surrender. Tell us that story.
Yes, the story of Appomattox is both compelling and controversial. I believe Chamberlain was invited by Grant or Grant's generals to lead the surrender at Appomattox. There is no written order, and that's part of the controversy. But my tutor and mentor, James McPherson, great Civil War historian at Princeton, makes the point that at the very end of the war, lots of things happened that were never written down. They just happened so quickly. So Chamberlain is given the charge to accept the surrender. John Brown Gordon comes forward with his Confederate troops. I think in Chamberlain's mind, he was very much aware of the magnanimous peace that Grant had offered to Lee, and must have been thinking, well, what can I do to offer something of magnanimity also? Never one to accept the cause of the Confederacy, he wanted to accept the courage of the Confederate soldiers. So as they came forward to him, he changed his charge and to what's called a marching order, in which, in effect, he saluted the Confederate soldiers. Gordon, taken aback by this, dipped his sword to his toe and also came back with a salute to Chamberlain. And so this is a remarkable story of his magnanimity, which I think is part of, again, his heroism and his courage, which is a part of who he is.
Larissa, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
I think if Chamberlain was just the figure who had had the heroics on Little Round Top, he would perhaps be remembered for that. But it's these other aspects of his character, that magnanimity, that his heart, I think, that people, his humanity, that people really connect with. We hear, people talk about those other things when they come to the museum. And we get visitors from all over the place, including a lot of folks from the South. And they will talk about those different aspects of Chamberlain at Appomattox. And, I think it's his recognition of how horrendous that fight was for everybody involved. And while the Confederacy itself was, a scourge, people died on both sides, and there was just, it was an awful, awful time. And I think that people find the humanity in him in that story and lots of other things, the stammer. I think that these things make him seem like a real person that you could maybe know today, instead of somebody up on a pedestal that's unreachable.
Ron White, when he came back from the war, we've forgotten something very important, but to say that he did not come back from the war unchanged. And what I mean by that is physically unchanged.
Yes, 10 months after Gettysburg, in the battle at Petersburg, he is hit by a mini ball that goes in through one hip, goes through his bladder and urethra, tears apart blood vessels, doesn't exit from his other side, and two surgeons come to him and tell him he will die. He writes a remarkable letter to his wife, Fanny, telling her he believes that he will die, where he both talks of his faith and his love for her, and at the end tells her to live for the children. Fortunately, his younger brother, Tom, went to the 20th Maine and found two other surgeons, well known to Chamberlain, who extracted the bullet and saved his life. Modern physicians would say that the wounds that Chamberlain suffered would have rendered him about a 10% chance of survival. He did survive, but he suffered through his entire life from the terrible internal wounds. We're aware of the amputations in the Civil War, but modern scholars have talked about what they call the invisible wounds that no one saw, and Chamberlain never complained, but this really affected him. 2 weeks ago in Brunswick with Larissa, we were in the Chamberlain home and were reminded that in his study, he would have to literally lie on his couch. He couldn't sit upright. as he worked with his secretary and did his presidential duties. These wounds were terrible. He ultimately died from the infections of those wounds.
Yeah, I've heard historians say that he was the last Civil War veteran to die from his wounds. Larissa, how do you believe that his wounds affected his life after the war, if at all?
I think they had to have. Given how bad they were, despite the fact that he didn't complain, we know that he certainly suffered and was in a lot of pain a lot of the time. He had, follow-up surgeries that did not help, and in fact, one that made things worse. We don't know for sure, but it very likely would have affected his relationship with his wife in terms of a, sexual relationship. He must have channeled all of this into, the focus he had in doing all of the other things that he did in his life, becoming governor, becoming president, the business, involvements that he had, travel. He traveled all over the place. He went back down to Gettysburg. He went, to Egypt. He did things until very late in life. And he just was determined. It's like, there's also a story from his youth where his father tells him, the plow is broken or whatever. And his father tells him, he asks how to fix it, and his father says, do it, that's how. And that's another one of those lessons from his early life that he sort of carries throughout the rest of his life. He just figures it out, and he just puts one foot in front of the other. I think that also obviously touches people today. I mean, we all have various issues we have to deal with and suffering, and somehow we have to move forward. And he's a great example of that.
We'll go to Ronald calling from Lebanon. Hi, Ronald, go ahead.
Hi, I've been listening to this, and I remembered some of my readings of a very famous author on the Civil War, Shelby Foote, when he described the actions of Joshua Chamberlain at the surrender. He had determined that the men were going home. They needed to have food and a backpack and a good footwear. So he tried to provide them with the necessary items for surrender and returning home to their southern area. But he also realized, and this is one of the amazing things about Chamberlain, that the officers, some of the junior officers and medium rank officers, were going to be the senior people back home when everybody arrived there. And these men had created quite a vacuum in their home area. The people were not there to do the work. The people were not there to supervise and guide and provide future leadership. So Chamberlain was way ahead of himself and doing a fine job, because he required and made sure that the officers had a sidearm, no rifles, but a sidearm, ammunition, and food and everything that the other soldiers had, but also a horse. Nobody was allowed to have a horse except the officers. And Chamberlain's thoughts were, these men going back to their hometown and the farm were going to need to have some way of asserting their leadership and authority to keep the peace and bring the people and the community back together as a working unit. So that was his actions. And I found it amazing that He stepped forward and made sure those officers had a sidearm, a horse, and plenty of food, and they could return home with a little bit of grace.
Ronald, thank you for your call. Yeah, Ronald in Lebanon, thanks for your call. And Ron White, your response.
Thank you for your comment, Ronald. Yes, I think in this way, Chamberlain, as he did in several ways, followed out Grant's lead. Grant had really offered this to Lee, and Lee said to Grant, this will sit well with the men. And so I think Chamberlain followed out Grant's example in his own magnanimity towards the Southern soldiers.
Ron, thank you for your call. Ron, when Joshua Chamberlain came home from the war, he was restless and wasn't quite sure he wanted to just go back to being a professor, and did not. Instead, ended up governor of Maine. Tell us how that happened and tell us what kind of governor he was.
Yes, I've thought a lot about the men who came home from the Civil War or World War II. In many ways, this was the high point of their life, and yet they were quite young when this all took place. He wasn't sure what he wanted to do, but the Republicans in Maine quickly discovered what they wanted him to do. And so they nominated him to be governor. And in those days, the governorship in Maine was a single year term. So I calculated all the previous governors and the average term of service was 1.5 years. But Chamberlain was elected once, twice, three times, four times. Very, very unusual to be elected four times. Politics was not always easy for him. He had to deal with the whole temperance lobby. Maine was the first in what became called the Maine Law. And although he himself was a person who did not drink much at all, he thought that the temperance lobby was very overbearing and was going to take away the rights of other people who didn't quite believe in that. It was a Roman Catholic constituency who was not into temperance. Also, he had to deal with a really difficult issue of the death penalty. The death penalty was on the books in Maine, but the practice had been that when someone was convicted of death, they were never executed. It just passed away. And Chamberlain said, either we will abolish the death penalty, which he would have been for, or we're going to have to follow through with the execution of a person convicted. He followed through, and that became a great controversy for him. So in some ways, it was a successful presidency. Like Lincoln, Grant, he also believed, as Republican, in a more activist government. He wanted to have, for example, the government supply bonds to give to the railroads, which were needed to expand Maine's industry after the Civil War. So it was quite a remarkable governorship, but not free of controversy.
Calling in now is Mary Poles, an author, book and film critic, and media relations editor for Bates College. Mary, I'm so glad you called. And I asked Mary to call in because I stumbled an article you wrote for Down East Magazine, Mary, talking about one of the legends surrounding Joshua Chamberlain, and this specifically about his beloved horse, Charlemagne. Tell us what you had heard and what you found out.
Well, first of all, I've pestered Larissa about this in the past when I was reporting that story. But the legend, there is this legend in Brunswick that that Joshua Chamberlain loved his horse Charlemagne so much that when the horse died, he buried it on the island that he could see from Dom Hegan, his summer residence down at Simpson's Point. In reporting that story, I tried to prove it, disprove it, really bugged everybody at the museum, and I took a trip out there and walked around. And I'm just wondering if this is something, Ronald, that you encountered in your research. Did it intrigue you as much as it intrigues me? If so, I'd just love to hear.
Ronald, you do write a great deal about Joshua Chamberlain's beloved horse Charlemagne, their bond, and what a remarkable horse it was. Have you heard the rumor, the legend that it's buried on Crow Island, or heard something else about Charlemagne?
Well, first of all, I think it's so important for a 21st century audience to understand the importance of horses in the 19th century. Not simply Chamberlain, but others, their horse was just like a beloved companion. And so he does bring Charlemagne home after the Civil War. Charlemagne had been wounded himself several times during the Civil War. He becomes the family pet. I might defer to Larissa to know, I haven't followed out that story or that rumor of where he was buried and if he was buried. I'm probably prepared to believe it's true, but I haven't really checked that one out.
Yeah, I'm going to remain stumped too, because we don't have any clear-cut answer on that. I think short of digging up the entire island to see if there's any horse DNA out there, we're probably not going to ever learn the truth. But I think it's another one of these, you know, fascinating, heartwarming stories about Chamberlain that people just love. I mean, a man who loves animals, a person who loves animals is usually a pretty, you know, lovable person. He also had dogs that he adored. There's a great photo of him with his hand resting on Tiberius Caesar, Tibby's head, his dog later in life. And it's just, you know, it just again makes him all the more human.
Well, Mary, thanks so much for calling in. And your article about the legend is it the April 2023 issue of Downey's Magazine?
Oh, it's an issue devoted to Ireland. It's an awesome issue. And I think it's either April or last June. I'm not sure. But if you just Google Chamberlain and Horse and Downey and Crow, I think you'll find it.
Thanks so much for calling in, Mary. And let's see, I'm trying to do it really quickly and I'm not. Oh, on the June 2023 Island issue. There we go. So thanks for calling in. And if you want to call in with your questions, 1-800-399-3566. Send us a quick email, talk@mainepublic.org, or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Life and Times of Joshua Chamberlain. Joining me, Larissa Picard, the executive director of the Pejepscot History Center, and Ronald White, the author of a new biography of Joshua Chamberlain. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Larissa, I understand you have a special event coming up at the museum. Tell us about it.
Yes, we have had a Santa Day holiday event for about 16 or 17 years now, and it's always been at our headquarters right along downtown in Brunswick. But this year, it's the 40th anniversary of owning the Chamberlain Museum, and Santa will be in the Chamberlain Parlor visiting with friends on December 9th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The entire downstairs will be decorated and people can just come in and see the house for free. Families, anybody of any age are welcome. You needn't stand in line for Santa. You can come in and just see the house. There'll be refreshments and so forth. It'll be a wonderful, fun way of sharing the house and the story. We will have docents on hand to answer questions as well. So it's just another way to share Chamberlain's and his family's life with folks. And we have a museum shop, and that will be open as well.
Well, you know, I'm looking at the clock and I'm realizing there's so many aspects of Joshua Chamberlain we haven't discussed yet on the program. But Ron, I think that one of the more interesting stories or couple of stories that I didn't know about are the times that Chamberlain was deployed to the State House in Augusta to quell potential violence there. Tell us about those times and maybe how they illustrate the tenor of the times.
Yes, I think in my book tour, this particular story has elicited so much interest. We're aware of an election in 2020 and all of the tumult that surrounded that. And we thought that was a one of a kind. It never had happened before, but actually it had happened before and it happened in the state of Maine. So in 1879, an election took place in which it appeared that the Republicans had won both the governorship and the House and the Senate. And then what happened was called the Great Countout. And the Secretary of State began to count out votes. Oh, this was signed on a ballot with one column instead of two. Oh, you put your initials instead of the full name. And so one by one by one by one, votes were discounted. And suddenly the Republicans, which thought they were in the lead, were in the minority. And men began running, coming to Augusta armed in what would potentially be an insurrection. So the Democratic governor, Arcelon, actually contacted Chamberlain, a Republican, and said, would you come to Augusta and become the, in a sense, military governor in this tumultuous situation? Chamberlain arrived on January 5, 1880. He was ultimately threatened with kidnapping, even death. A Republican newspaper called him a traitor to the Republican cause. And on a very dramatic moment, one afternoon, as men were rushing the Capitol, Chamberlain came to the rotunda and offered these words, if I may. Men, you wish to kill me. I hear, killing is no new thing to me. I've offered myself to be killed many times when I no more deserved it than I do now. You understand what you want, do you? I'm here to preserve the peace and honor of the state until the right government is seated. Whichever it may be, it is not for me to say. I am here for that, and I shall do it. If anybody wants to kill me for it, here I am. Let him kill. And with that, Chamberlain opened his coat and presented his body to be killed. Suddenly, a veteran in the crowd called out, by God, old general, the first man who dares to lay a hand on you, I'll kill him on the spot. And the crowd drifted away. I believe this was Chamberlain's finest moment, perhaps even finer than Little Round Top. He actually wrote to Fanny the next day, this was a second Little Round Top. The state Supreme Court did act. They elected the Republican as the president, as the governor. The House and the Senate went Republican. And Chamberlain received letters from all across the country commending his incredible stand, his great courage. This is a story that needs to be told alongside of Little Round Top to really tell the full compass of the man's courage and leadership.
Larissa, I see you nodding. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's another reason why I would encourage people to pick up this book, because the narrative, you know, the entire story of Chamberlain's life is amazing. And Ron really gives the weight that it needs to certain stories like the one he just talked about. It's extremely powerful reading. The best biographies are, you get swept away in that person's life and the times, but you also see how it connects to today, and you feel the same things that that person is feeling and so forth. And it really reads like that. It's an amazingly well-written, well-paced, very readable book. And it, you know, that story is a great example of why Chamberlain is so relevant still today. There are so many aspects of his life, the disability and the suffering, this sort of stand that he took against this insurrection. These are things that we can understand that are in our lives, in society. And, you know, I think that we can learn from by reading things like this. I get a little swept away talking about this. Very powerful stuff.
Ron, I'm going to try to get to a couple emails that I think you might be able to answer quickly. Here's one from Ted. He writes, I've never been able to find primary sources for his physical characteristics. For example, sandy hair, blue eyes, height of 5'10 and a half in your book. Can you guide me to those sources? How'd you find that out?
Well, there are descriptions of him by his friends and colleagues, and I tried to sort of piece them together to come up with what I thought was a physical description of him. He doesn't do this himself. It's really written by others.
An email here from Bruce. Chamberlain is a hero to me, and I run into deeds he wrote from time to time. I also eat my lunch next to his grave occasionally. My first visit to Gettysburg was when I was 9, and I have returned many times, even bringing our Brunswick Boy Scout troop to camp there when Pickett gathered for the charge, where Pickett gathered for the charge. There's a story here in Brunswick that Grant and Sherman visited Chamberlain, and at dinner, Joshua decided they should all carve their initials into the table. That table went missing at some point and has never been recovered. It's rumored that whoever has it understands its value and won't give it back to the museum. Is that true? I guess that's a question for you, Larissa.
Boy, I wish I knew. And I wish I knew who that supposed person is. Yes, that is, we have been very fortunate over time to recover items that went astray, were sold off and such by later family members or others who purchased the building. But that is one item that is legendary, like Charlemagne's burial. And we would love to see. We do know Grant came to the house for sure. And, you know, imagine if we were able to show that to people, all of our visitors from all over the place. It would be fantastic to have it available to the public. But I have no idea where it is.
An email from Thomas. Can one or all the guests discuss the men of the 20th Maine who are at Little Round Top and their heroism and suffering in battle? I believe Chamberlain had a high respect and appreciation for his fellow veterans and their effort and sacrifice in battle. Ron.
Chamberlain did. He spoke eloquently across the state of Maine and really in Boston, Philadelphia, and New York. But he also understood what became, I call it, the Second Civil War, where men first came home and talked about their courage, but then they began to disagree with each other. They began to fight each other with words, not weapons. So even when they gathered in 1889 at Gettysburg to dedicate the monuments to Little Round Top and Big Round Top, Chamberlain understood that there were men within the 20th Maine survivors who had a differing understandings of what really took place. And I thought in another remarkable part of his leadership, he said to them, "You are all right. You are all right." He didn't want these disagreements to destroy the great comradeship that they had built, not simply in the Civil War, but in the years that followed.
Michael on Facebook asks, how did Chamberlain's membership in the United Masonic Lodge in Brunswick affect his life and values? Larissa, do we know much about his membership in the Masonic Lodge?
That's one I really, unfortunately, can't answer for you. I'm sure if we had some of our docents on the program today, they may be able to. But that I don't know specifically about, I'm afraid. Happy to try to get an answer for that person, though.
I want to be clear before we wrap up, but we only have a couple minutes left, Ron, that Joshua Chamberlain had his faults and not just a stammer. And one of them that you write about is that he had, I don't know if the right word is nonchalant, but he didn't really feel passionately about the plight of the freed slaves after the Civil War, it seems.
Yes. I talk about the three great Mainers, Oliver Otis Howard, who became head of the Freedmen's Bureau, ultimately Howard University, Delbert Ames, who ultimately became governor of Mississippi. These were in two completely different geographical situations in which they had to grapple with the rights of African Americans. Delbert Ames became incredibly unpopular among the white citizens of Mississippi because he took up the cause of African Americans. Chamberlain really did not speak about this issue. And from our modern standpoint, we might wish to criticize him. I would also remind us that he lived in Maine. His views were what he could do for Maine, and he was not involved in the issue of civil rights. He has supported the 13th, 14th, and 15th so-called Reconstruction Amendments, but he was largely silent on the issue of the rights of African Americans.
Just a few seconds left, Larissa, but we can't wrap up the show without mentioning Fanny, an unusual woman.
Yeah, amazing. And I think we've been trying to do, you know, talk more about the entire family, about Fanny's life. You obviously don't have as much of a record except for their letters, far fewer photographs. But she was a very powerful figure. And Ron does go into some of her biography as well. She was a very talented artist and musician. She had a strong, you know, will and personality. She also suffered a great deal. She had severe eye pain and went blind late in life. So, you know, their relationship had some controversy to it, and struggle, but they were also very, very connected people for sure.
Thank you both. That was Larissa Picard, the executive director of the Penobscot History Center. Also with us, Ronald White, the author of Great On Great Fields, The Life and Unlikely Heroism of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, how the communities affected by the October 25th tragedy are doing now, a month later. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.